The short version of my story is child abuse led to childhood addiction. So I found my first drug when I was 12. It was alcohol. It made me feel like I was more relaxed. Like my pain was, you know, more at a distance. And at 16, I found what became my drug of choice, which was methamphetamine. I was looking for a pain management tool. I had a really life-threatening kidnapping and rape by three men that lasted 6 hours that I didn't think I was going to survive. I had a violent boyfriend. It just felt like I couldn't get away from it. Like no matter what I was doing, no matter what I was trying to do, the violence followed me for a very long time.
Welcome to today's episode of Falling to Freedom, where addiction ends and faith begins. The weekly podcast that brings thoughtful, informed, and challenging discussions about addiction to the forefront of everyone's minds. We join our host now, Chad Lacombe, for today's topic.
All right. Well, today we're joined by a special guest, Mary Beth O'Connor. She is the author of From Junkie to Judge, One Woman's Triumph Over Trauma and Addiction. That's kind of a spoiler, sharing the title of the book about her story. But we're excited because, you know, we truly believe in our heart that no matter what your past, even if it's been horrendous with addiction, that you don't have to let that define your future. And she's just a shining example of someone that didn't let that define her past and rose way above that and into a very respected position. So without editorializing your story, I'd like to just turn it over to you, Mary Beth, and let you, you know, share, you know, the depths that you came from and even the heights that you reached.
Sure. So I think that the short version of my story is child abuse led to childhood addiction, right? And that is just a very common pathway. And so for me, I grew up in a household with a mother who really wasn't bonded to me and who could be violent. But when I was 9, it got a lot worse because she married my stepfather. And he was very violent with her, physically, sexually violent with me. It was just a very high-stress environment where I never knew what was going to happen. And where what I did and what happened to me, there wasn't a very close connection between those two things. And so it was under a lot of strain. And so I found my first drug when I was 12. It was alcohol, and it was Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill Wine.
Oh, which a lot wow. of people know. Rough stuff.
Common introductory drug, obviously.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Especially in my day. And what I noticed about it was how much better it made me feel. I mean, I think we under discuss that in the beginning, the drugs work. And so it made me feel like I was more relaxed, like my pain was, you know, more at a distance. Like I was sort of laughing and having a happy time in a more openly joyful way. Mm-hmm. And that captured my attention. Like, you know, this is great. You know, I need more of this. And so I pursued alcohol right away. I, you know, make opportunities to drink. I'd even steal beer from my stepfather because that's how much I wanted the alcohol. Mm. But I also quickly added weed. I did pills. I did a lot of acid, LSD my sophomore year of high school. And at 16, I found what became my drug of choice, which was methamphetamine.
Was there just out of curiosity, because I mean, like my experience and a lot of people, you know, there's certainly a progression there. Right. Where, you know, like you said, starting with alcohol and just kind of progressing through these things where maybe you couldn't even imagine yourself doing some of these other things when you start, but through that process, they become a reality.
Yeah. I mean, and I will say that most people who use all drugs use in moderation, right? I mean, the subset of us that use to excess usually have, especially when you're using the excess as a teen, usually there's trauma or untreated mental health in the background of that. I mean, that's usually what happens. And so for me, it wasn't actually I was actually always excited to try the next drug. Like, you know, I mean, the first time I did meth, like I was like, that was a great day for me. I mean, in my mind, this was like a happy time. So I never, it wasn't that I wasn't hesitating to go from one drug to the next. I was always, it would always capture my attention when somebody talked about a new drug or, trying to get opportunities to do it. But that's because I was looking for a pain management tool. The typical person who starts out with alcohol or weed, they don't progress, naturally into doing meth. Usually they stop there or they occasionally do other things. The excess use is a red flag, that something else is going on. And that's how it was for me.
Okay, so maybe you could develop a little more of your story, and the things that had happened maybe in your youth. I mean, I'm sure a lot of listeners can relate to that, would be encouraged by knowing they're not the only ones going through those things, and how you decided to cope with it with substances.
And so I'm shooting meth by 17. I mean, I used intravenously. I shot up the first time when I was 17. I was really in full bore addiction when I graduated high school, but I did go to college. I left Central Jersey to come to California. I graduated from Berkeley. And for the first couple of years of college, I did better, not good, but better. But I had other violent episodes during college. I had a really life-threatening kidnapping and rape by three men that lasted 6 hours that I didn't think I was going to survive. I had a violent boyfriend. And it was sort of like the little grip that I got during college, I really lost it. And by January of my senior year, I was using meth again on a regular basis. And I didn't get sober till 32. So it was a really long haul for me. It was really almost basically 15 years of extreme drug use. And then by 32, I'm having a lot of problems. I can't hold a job. I'm having physical problems. I'm feeling very trapped, like I'm living in this horrible little box of chaos and misery, and my partner was ready to throw me out, and so it was sort of like all of those things together made me finally go to rehab when I was 32 years old, and that's also common. I know in the movies it's like this big epiphany moment when but a lot of us, it's a wearing down process that gets us to finally be ready to address the issue, and that's what happened to me at 32, and so I started rehab. And when I went into sobriety recovery, I also did know that the violence was underneath my drug use. And so when I got home from rehab, I found a therapist with expertise in trauma. And so I, like many, I had to address both in order to get a stable recovery. And she, to my surprise, but correctly, diagnosed me with PTSD, which for me showed up as very, very severe anxiety in my early recovery. For years into my recovery, that was a problem. And so I had to, the recovery process was multifaceted, as it is for many people. It wasn't just getting sober or maintaining sobriety. If I was going to be live a happy and productive life, I had to deal with the trauma. I had to deal with my mental health, or I wasn't ever going to really recover in the full sense of that word.
How long were you living in that abusive situation? Was it just a short period and then you moved out or ran away or something, or was it like an extended period?
The abusive boyfriend?
Even as you're in the childhood and everything. I mean, just kind of
I mean,
get an
I live.
idea.
Yeah, I mean, I the last abuse episode that happened to me was when I was around 36 when my mother beat me in a car. Like that was the last time anybody ever physically abused me. But from when I was born, but especially once moving with my stepfather until I moved in with my partner that I ended up marrying after I got sober. So until I was out of college, that's where most of the violence happened. The worst violence was from 9 to 23. That was the worst of it.
So pretty much your whole life of drug use, there was abuse like right alongside that.
Yes. For most of that time, there was. That's true. And it also felt like, I mean, when I left home, New Jersey, to go to college, I sort of thought, oh, maybe this is my opportunity to get away from that, right? Maybe this will be a break, and I'll be able to build a life without that. But a lot of women who are abused do choose abusive partners, as I did for a while. Lived with him for a year. I mean, that's a common pattern because you don't really appreciate sort of What would be a deal breaker for other people? For me, it was like, well, it's not as bad as what I grew up with, right? But also, he had had an abusive childhood. And so there was sort of like that mutuality of understanding of what it was like to live like that. So that's a common pattern. Of course, sexual assault in college, it happens to a lot of women. So it just felt like I couldn't get away from it. Like, no matter what I was doing, no matter what I was trying to do, the violence followed me for a very long time.
Yeah, it's interesting how, when you're living in those kind of situations, you can actually, in your mind, normalize things that are not normal at all, and it's like,
That's true, but it was normal in my world. I mean, I wasn't just normalizing, it was normal in the world that I grew up in. I mean, I knew that it wasn't normal in the out rest of the world. You know, like I understood that this wasn't happening to every child. But in my household, it was the way it was for, I lived with that for 10 years with my stepfather. That's a very long time to get conditioned into that.
Oh, absolutely. And were you ever, was there ever any run-ins with the law or?
I got arrested right out of high school for methamphetamine and hypodermics. And so I had to put college off for a year, but they treated me really lightly. They allowed me to go to college. They allowed me to get my record expunged. And so I didn't have a long history of a criminal record. In fact, I wrote a piece for the Los Angeles Times that's on my website, junketajudge.com, about how if I would have been a person of color, I probably would have had a longer criminal record. And therefore might never have been able to be a lawyer or a judge. But like for the last 10 years, I had meth on me every day. I was stopped by the police multiple times for speeding or minor accidents, and I was never searched. And so I didn't have a lot of criminal law consequences for my drug use. Yes.
Okay. So you said it, what, 30, I think you said 32 or 33 is when this process of recovery and getting free from the addiction started.
Yes, 32. I went into like a longer term rehab, but it was a 90-day minimum, and I ended up staying for 5 months. So I was in a longer term treatment program, which is what I felt I needed.
Was this in California or was this?
Yeah, I live in the Bay Area, and this was in the Bay Area.
Okay, so you want to maybe share a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I mean, in my mind, when I'm going to rehab, right, I'm going for medical treatment, right? Like I did understand I had a medical condition. Today, of course, it's characterized as a mental health disorder. It's in the diagnostic manual of mental health disorders. But when I got to my rehab, it turned out it wasn't the best fit for me because it was really adamantly, exclusively a 12-step program. And they didn't tell me that. And 12 steps, of course, is Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous and all of the Anonymouses. Which a lot of people do well with, but it's definitely not right for everyone. And it was a terrible fit for me. And I told them that. And they kept telling me, this is all there is. You have to do what we say. And it was like, well, I can't do that. And so even in early recovery, I had to sort of take ownership of my recovery plan and decide what I was going to do. And so, I did all the homework in rehab. I read all of the AA Big Book and the NA text, but I never really adopted that program, although I pulled some ideas out. And then when I got home from rehab, and I'll emphasize for the younger people, it's January of 94, and there was like no Google, okay? But I thought, is there any other options? And I actually got in my car and went to the library, and it turned out there were other options. They just didn't tell me about them. And so,
Oh,
yes.
what?
And this still happens today. I wish I could say that that was because it was 94 and now it's 2025 and it doesn't happen, but it still happens much too often today. And so I found other options, Women for Sobriety, which still exists, the Parent to Smart Recovery, and the parent organization to LifeRing Secular Recovery. And I'm on the board for LifeRing. And those programs were much more supportive of my individual approach to it, of my self-empowerment, taking sort of ownership of my recovery plan. I mean, don't get me wrong, I listened. Like, I viewed it as my job to listen to anybody with more experience or success than I had. But I always viewed myself as filtering it for, do I think this is a good strategy or technique for me to use? Well, do I think that's going to be a good fit for me? And that's how I viewed it. But I definitely listened and sort of proactively was seeking out every idea and, philosophy and thought that I could find to make sure that I had exposure to as many possible strategies as I could so that I could have the most options and, the most to pick from.
Okay, so 5 months in that program, and then what happens after that?
Yeah, so I went home and I got, as I said, I got into therapy. I found my therapist, and I was in therapy for my trauma, 3 years individual therapy, a couple years on anti-anxiety meds because my anxiety was very, very severe, and then 6 years in a therapy group with women with trauma histories. So that was sort of the recovery side of it, and then on the sort of professional side of it, when I got home from rehab. I had a you know a Berkeley degree in good grades, and I had like an embarrassing resume. Like, I mean, it was embarrassing. My terminology is that after college, I had worked my way down the corporate ladder. You know, like that's what happened, because I couldn't get to work and I couldn't concentrate. And so, you know, when you in early recovery for a lot of us, there's this like this impulse to make up for lost time. You know, I'm 32. I need to catch up to where I would have, should have, could have been, right? But the reality was nobody was going to hire me for a career job with that resume, and I wasn't really ready. And so I really had to like, you know, suck it up and be realistic and be patient. And I started with part-time, temporary, low-level work. And it took me 6 years to work my way into sort of a middle management position at a tech company. And then at 6 years of sobriety, I went to Berkeley Law. So that was sort of where I started off professionally.
Okay, so you go to Berkeley Law, and was this like when you went to Berkeley the first time, was that your goal was law?
Yes. In fact, I had actually gotten accepted to Berkeley Law right out of college, and I tried to go. But remember, I started using meth again in January of my senior year of college. And by the time I got to law school in the fall, I was in no shape to do
Yeah,
it. Like, I
no,
couldn't
no.
get there, right? And so I had withdrawn and handed back a top 10 law school because of my addiction. So that was agonizing. So yes, it had been my original plan. But when I got sober, I wasn't ready for it. But I also really needed to deal with the fear of trying again, you know? And so I did end up going, and I will say also, I was 39 when I started law school. I was 42 when I graduated. So it was, you know, sort of, that midlife, you know, change, although for me it was not really the middle because I hadn't really started until 32.
Well, I
And so
think
that's
that'll
sort of how that progressed. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that'll be encouraging to a lot of listeners, you know, because there's a lot of people that get trapped in that lifestyle. It's decades, you know, and so I think that's a very typical thing to, you know, come out of it in maybe 30s or 40s for a lot of people. And so you can, you know, there's the temptation at that point to feel like, well, everything's gone, you know, there's no opportunity now. And I mean, it seems, I know my own life and sounds like yours and many people, you know, when you're in addiction, you're destroying lots of opportunities in life, right? You're destroying relationships, but also professional and personal opportunities. And it can seem like, you know, those are gone forever. But that's one of the things I love about your story is that it doesn't have to be, right? I mean, yeah, you're not going to get the time back. But that doesn't have to be the end of the story. So,
Yeah. I mean, it's not like I got sober and thought I'll be a judge one day or even get
right.
law school back. I swear to you, my first professional goal out of rehab was literally, let's not get fired again. Like, this is what I wanted to do, right? I mean, that's where I was. And I did think, like you're talking about, I thought, okay, you know, I'm 32. I've wasted my education. I've, you know, destroyed all these areas of life. Sure, things can get better, but they can sort of only get like this much better. Like in my mind, there was like a limit as to how better they could get. And it turned out that that wasn't true. I mean, I have 31 years of sobriety now. 31 years is a long time, and you
Yeah.
can do a lot in 31 years.
Sure.
And the other thing I'll say is, you know, I'm becoming a judge. You know, after law school, I worked at a big firm, and eventually I became a federal administrative law judge. I'm proud of that accomplishment, but the truth is, it's not actually the core of what is sort of the best part of recovery. I mean, for me, the essence of the joy of recovery is the lack of chaos, the lack of obsession, that I'm not making challenging situations worse, and I'm not
Right.
creating challenges that don't need to be there, right? I mean, these are some of sort of the basic fundamental benefits of recovery that allow you to sort of spend your brain, spend your energy, spend your time in better places. And that builds up over time. It's amazing how even small steps can lead to great progress given enough time.
Yeah. So a quality of life not dependent on your professional, you know, occupation. So when you said you graduated law school, went to work at a firm, eventually, I'm not sure how do you become a judge? Is that like offered to you or do you apply for it? I mean, how does a person become, go from a lawyer to a judge?
It depends on the kind of judge that it is, you know. So I was a federal administrative law judge. So for me, it was a testing process and then an interview process to get the job. And so I was appointed a federal judge. I'll also emphasize when I had 20 years sober. And so, it was a while, a process to get to that point. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, 20 years sober, I applied. I made, it's a very competitive, as you can imagine, it's very
sure.
competitive to get that job. And I made it through. Yeah.
Did your past come up at all? Was that even an issue or consideration?
So like when I applied to the California bar, right? So they don't ask you, have you ever done drugs? Because they would get way too many yeses. Right.
No, nobody would get in.
So what they ask is about the last 5 years. And when they asked about 5 years, I had 9 years sober. And then I became a lawyer for the federal government. And they asked, I believe, about 7 years, and I had 14. And when I was appointed a judge, in the security clearance, they asked me about 10 years, and I had 20. So I could always say no until I could always tell the truth and tell them nothing. But at the same time, when I was a judge, I did join the board for Life Ring Secular Recovery, and I joined the board for She Recovers Foundation. And those are considered outside activities.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to run it through ethics. And so at that point, I did tell them, but I told them sort of generally, you know, like, I have 23 years sober. I'm going to be on this board. I'm going to do this. Is that okay? And they said yes. And so that was the point at which that was the first time I ever disclosed to an employer that I was even in recovery.
Sure. But at that point, you'd already established yourself. You had a track record. So
yes.
Thankfully, they were basing their decisions based on who you were that day, not who you were 20 years ago.
That's right. And that's right. And I mean, and the reality is that this is one of the things that's nice. I mean, even then, I mean, I wouldn't have talked openly the way I do now. I'm retired as a federal judge. And when I retired, it really opened up a lot of new opportunities for me because I felt free to tell my whole story in a new way, because I didn't have to worry about professional ramifications or even just that being out there would sort of interfere with my ability to effectively do my job in some way. You know, I mean, I wouldn't have allowed that. It's important that I do the job to the best of my ability and not have an outside distraction. But because I'm retired now, it's allowed me to write and speak. And, you know, I actually train lawyers and judges. So it's opened a new, window for me to think about how to be of service to my community, my recovery mm-hmm. community, in a way that I felt I really couldn't be when I was working.
Okay. So what, like, administrative law judge, you know, I think most people, when they think of a judge, are thinking like criminal courts.
Right.
So, I mean, what's like the big difference between that and what kind of cases would come before your desk?
Yeah, so there's also a lot of different kind of ALJs, they're called, right? But for me, federally, you work for a specific agency, and I worked for the Social Security Administration. So I handled cases that were related to Social Security. So I never handled criminal cases, although drug and alcohol use came up in disability decisions that I had to make. There's very clear law about that in regard to getting Social Security disability. So that's what I did.
Okay. Well, you have to follow the law, but you can also,
yes.
I don't know if there's any discretion in there, but you're able to use your experiences where discretion is allowed. So that's interesting.
Yeah. And it was more also just about the way that, you know, I didn't have the bias, right, that some people might have about mm-hmm. making unfair judgments about people
sure,
because they have a history of substance use, you know, those kind of things. I think it came up more that way. I understood where it came from. And also the reality is I could see from a lot of their mental health treatment records that a lot of them had histories like mine. They had trauma or they had untreated mental health conditions. And so I just understood it and was able to, I think, interact with them in a way that I got the information I needed to apply the law I was required to apply, but, you know, sort of in a neutral way, not in a judgmental way or a biased way.
Sure. And how long were you on the bench?
5.5 years.
Okay. 5.5 years in San Francisco, in the Bay Area.
In the Bay Area, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's quite the contrast, right? And I think that, you know, that was really what I thought was, you know, the the main point is just highlighting the fact that, you know, going through all of that stuff and all of the challenges and hurdles before you, you know, you didn't let that dictate who you were going to be and define you, and you rose to, really, I mean, that's, you know, one of the heights of the legal profession, I would imagine, right? I mean, being a judge and not for, not available to every single person. So it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's why I titled my book From Junkie to Judge. I tried to show, like, in just a short couple words, the arc of it, you know, and for me, it's a way of saying recovery can be more amazing than you can imagine when you first get sober. There are going to be more opportunities, more pathways that you can take professionally and in your personal life than you can imagine. And so I try to use that judge title as a way to give hope to people about their future. Sure. But I'm also saying I use it as an ear opener too. So like when I talk, you know, when I talk to the public or do trainings, people, I think they listen to me a little harder because of the judge title.
Sure,
and so I try
credibility.
Yes, right, exactly. I mean, I've got 31 years of sobriety. I'm a former federal judge. I'm, you know, on these boards. I have, you know, a lot of writing about, I have a lot of expertise on the topic. And so I try to use it just to sort of get information out there that I think is important for people to know.
That's great. We've covered your past and this rise into the bench and, you know, recovery a little bit. What kind of things are you doing today? You know, what are you involved in? Obviously, you wrote the book, From Junkie to Judge. So we encourage people, you know, that are interested in this conversation, go on, what is it, on Amazon and different places? Go find the book, buy the book. But what else is going on?
Yeah, so I mean, just to address the book first, yes, it's, you know, From Junkie to Judge. And I really emphasize the subtitle, One Woman's Triumph Over Trauma and Addiction. And I try to make my book useful, and I thought about the structure. So the first third of the book is my pre-drug use childhood, to sort of put in context why that excessive drug use at that age made sense to me. And then the last third is actually my first 3 years of recovery, trauma recovery and sobriety recovery, because I wanted sort of a more realistic example of an individual plan approach to recovery. And so I try to make the book useful. I mean, yes, it's on Amazon and all the usual sites, and bookstores have it or can get it.
And I'm assuming it's, you know, it would be appropriate for men and women, even though,
yes,
you know, it's your journey, but
men and women. And it's also, I mean, even the techniques I use, a lot of 12-step people use those techniques. So it's not even, you know, just for non-12-step people. But it is one of the only memoir I know of that is more focused on building a plan, a personal plan. So there's that. And then I do write opinion pieces. I've had pieces in the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times and Recovery Today. And those are on my website, which is junkietojudge.com. I do a lot of speaking and trainings. I do keynotes, let's say, for a recovery organization. I have workshops about peer support options. I have workshops for targeted towards psychologists about substance use and mental health interplay. I have workshops for, you know, humanist groups and free thinker groups about secular recovery. And of course, I create things. I also train lawyers and judges. They have continuing legal ed requirements, and I created a substance use in the legal professions training that I do. And then I'm on the board, as I said, for Life Ring Secular Recovery, and I'm on the board for She Recovers.
So you're not very busy at all.
No. My husband says I should look retirement up in the dictionary, you know, but I will say I do all this, I swear to you, it's part-time. And the beauty of it is that I really thought hard about what role I wanted. And because I thought, you know, in the recovery space, there's a lot of things I could do. And so the fun part is I got to think about, what do I like doing, right? Well, I like writing, and I like talking, and I like interacting. And so all of those things are a lot of what I do. And then I'll also say, for people interested in these topics, my social media is very narrowly targeted to those topics. I never post anything outside of substance use, addiction, mental health, trauma, and the recoveries. And I post new studies that come out. There is more research that's been done in the last 10 and 15 years. I post articles. I post my recovery thoughts. And so I'm on X, and I'm on Blue Sky and LinkedIn. And if you're interested in those topics, I don't go outside of that lane. Like, this is my focus. This is what I want to share information about. And so,
and is that also at Junkie to Judge on those platforms?
It's actually at Mary Beth O _ on X, and it's Mary Beth O'Connor on Blue Sky.
Okay. Good. So people that are interested can go to those places and get updates. We'll certainly be checking them out, seeing these articles and stuff that you're posting. Okay, so do you want to kind of develop a little more about some of the things that you're doing today?
I mean, that really is the, you know, the overall description. The other thing is people can message me through my website and I answer, other than spam, I answer right. all messages. And so if people have questions or opportunities, feel free sure. to reach out. But I mean, my goal is to try to, you know, as I said, it's to educate, to reduce stigma. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, I talk about the fact that I, you know, shot up, right? Which I think is more stigmatized than just, you know, drinking or popping pills. I wanted to own the whole picture, but it also does, I hope, show that no matter how bad your addiction is, and no matter how much you got piled on with whatever trauma may have happened to you or other challenges in life, you know, there is a recovery from all of it. And that's how I really think about the recovery. So the development of the problems had an interplay, right? The trauma interplayed with the drug addiction, interplayed with getting PTSD and anxiety, but the recoveries have an interplay too. Mm-hmm. And so they sort of, they support each other and work together if you tackle them both, especially from the beginning, which we know now is sort of the right way. Sure. The other thing, one of the other things I do often talk about is the positive news, because I think we hear so much negative, like, oh, only 10% of people recover or 15%. And it's like, none of that is true. I mean, the sure. majority of people do recover from their addiction in their lifetime, usually not on the first effort, but in their lifetime. And the other thing is that once you hit 5 years of continuous sobriety, you have an 85% chance of never relapsing again. And so part of what I try to do when I talk to friends and families is give them hope and explain these things. And I do also talk to friends and families about what they can do to be supportive, but also sort of what they shouldn't do. And so I read about an hour a day to make sure I stay up on, you know, stay current with what's going on in the field so that I can talk from a place of expertise and try to share useful information.
Sure. What do you think about the rise of fentanyl? I'm pretty sure that had you or I been living the life we were in today's age, we'd probably be dead with fentanyl the way it is, and just how, you know, it doesn't take much and it's in everything. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, you know, fentanyl's there because it's cheaper to produce than heroin, right? I mean, that's why. And it's a much smaller, you know, it's a smaller volume to ship or to get over here. I mean, that's the whole sort of origin of it. A lot of it was related to when COVID hit, it was harder to get things shipped out of Afghanistan or wherever they got their heroin, the poppies from. And so they switched to chemical version of opiates. Certainly it's increased risk and people need to be aware of it. It's certainly why we need, you know, people need to have things like Narcan, you know, on hand, which is an opiate reversal drug. I mean, I don't use drugs. I have Narcan in my car. Because if you see somebody overdosing, it kicks the opioid off of the opioid receptor and they'll be able to breathe and revive. And the other thing about Narcan is if they're not actually having an overdose, if you think they are, but they aren't, it won't hurt them. And so like there's a woman who in the town next door to me, there was a 17-year-old overdosing in the park and she saved his life with Narcan. And so it's important to make sure that you, and I always do emphasize anybody with a teenager or 20 something living in their home, I think you really need to have Narcan in the house. Because the thing is that before fentanyl, usually the vast majority of people that died of overdose were long-term opiate users, usually heroin, long-term. But today, like you say, you know, fentanyl can be in a pill that looks like an Oxy. It can be in a pill that looks like a Percocet, or people can be trying something for the third time or the fifth time. So their family might not even know what's going on because they haven't had the long-term history where the behavior would change and the families right. might notice, right? And so right. having Narcan in the house is a safety net for that. But also, even if it's not your child, it could be one of their friends. And so it's a way to make sure you increase the safety level. So
I've interviewed yeah. several people that unfortunately lost children. You know, mm-hmm. they weren't fentanyl users. They bought pills off Snapchat.
Right.
Half a pill and it killed them.
Right. That's right.
19 years old. It's like, wow, it's brutal.
And I will say, I mean, this is when, you know, when you talk to younger people, I mean, we want to share, I think it's important to share the accurate risks of all drugs. I mean, not the exaggerated risks, but also not the minimizing risks, right? But The truth is that one harm reduction technique for young people who, you know, who use drugs occasionally is don't use alone. Don't use behind closed doors. You know, I mean, that is where the risk really goes up. And I think it is important for parents to have an honest conversation, but also to recognize reality, which is that a high percentage of kids do experiment with drugs. And so share information that will reduce the risk that they're not going to survive what used to be sort of a more casual experimentation.
Yeah. So I am curious, you know, just kind of given your situation, where you're living and the things that you're into, what is your opinion on California's permissive harm reduction policy? Because I don't know, for me, I think it's the wrong direction. I mean, it's personally, and I think we should be encouraging people not to use rather than, you know, trying to make them comfortable in their addiction. But just what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I'll say a couple things to that. One is that we don't have enough treatment for everybody today in California, right? And we can't flip a switch and get that. We talk like we do, but we don't. But the other reality is that people who use harm reduction are more likely to go into treatment. So for example, I use the needle exchange. It was new when at the end of my using, the late 80s, early 90s. It wasn't legal, but San Francisco allowed it because of HIV, was an epidemic at the time. Mm-hmm. The data shows that people who use, let's say, syringe services programs where they're getting clean needles, they're 3 to 5 times as likely to go into treatment. And so harm reduction can be an entry point to have a relationship with a caregiver, a provider who has information about treatment when you're ready, who can help you negotiate what is often a complicated system, especially if you don't have insurance and you don't have cash, which a lot of people that are, say, shooting drugs don't, not all of them, but a lot. So I don't view it as an either or. I mean, I want more treatment too. I want treatment on demand. I want us to have people have the opportunity to get into not just treatment, but appropriate treatment, treatment of the right length, treatment that also addresses their depression, also addresses their bipolar disorder. So the right treatment of the right length. I want sober living for when they leave, transitional housing. I want them to be able to have access to how to get a job after, you know, years of not working. All of those things are important. And I don't really feel that we have to make choices. I think we can do it all. We're choosing not to. And part of that is that, for example, incarcerating people for drug possession, which they still, you know, there's still, I think, 500,000 people in jail just for possession, not for any other crime. Mm-hmm. That's very, very expensive. And mm-hmm. so you could treat three to six people, depending on the system, for the price of incarcerating one. So it's not that there aren't dollars. It's, to me, it's about how we're allocating the dollars and what we're using them for. So okay. I think if we redirect the monies, we have enough money to do all of those things.
Sure. It needs to be more comprehensive.
Yes, it needs to be more comprehensive. It needs to be more focused on evidence-based solutions. And it needs to meet people where they are, but also when they're ready for treatment, don't put them on a 2-month wait list. give them a room, you know, get them in.
Okay. Well, you know, just to close out, you know, there's going to be people certainly that are in the midst of addiction and, you know, looking for answers, looking for solutions, options, things like that. What would be just a closing bit of advice that you would give someone that might be listening to this podcast?
I guess I would say that don't wait until you're sure you want to get sober. I will say that for me, when I went to rehab, I didn't actually think sobriety was on the table. Like, it wasn't that I wanted to keep using. It was that was sort of beyond my imagination. What I wanted was to do better. And so, you know, if you're ambivalent or sometimes you think yes and sometimes you think no, you can still start the recovery process. You can start going to meetings. You can start researching whether there are any treatment options for you and what they might be. You can start working, you know, trying to find a social worker or someone who can help you navigate the system. And so it doesn't, I guess I'm saying it in that most of us don't start out 100% ready, and yet we can still be successful. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that most of us aren't able to be perfectly abstinent from day one. And so if that's where you are, don't let that dissuade you. I mean, I used meth 3 times in my first 5 months. Now, Some people would say I failed, succeeded. I say 3 times in 5 months, like that was way better. I was using every day for many years, right? So it took me that much time to be able to get to the skills to have my brain sort of shut up about, you know, the screaming at me that I needed drugs a little bit in order to get sober. And so don't wait till you're ready to be perfect. Don't wait until you're sure. If you know that you have a problem or think that you might, start the process wherever you are, take the first steps, and you'd be surprised where that can lead you.
All right. So again, the book and the website, you wanted to say those real quick?
From Junkie to Judge, One Woman's Triumph Over Trauma and Addiction. And the website is junkietojudge.com.
All right. Well, Mary Beth O'Connor, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. And yeah, we just look forward to getting on your sites and seeing the articles and the things that you're putting out there.
Well, thank you. And it's been a great discussion. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you for being a part of this much-needed conversation as we expose the raw truths about addiction. Don't forget to like, follow, and most importantly, share. Remember, addiction is the dirty little secret that every family deals with, but nobody wants to talk about.